So today we have the third of our design context for service systems in the last three lectures. This is the last of our seven contexts. So I'm going to start by saying that I should pick a different word for that, because this is the context that we're design context. That doesn't quite sound right to me. Other than that, it's going to be a really exciting lecture, I think. I'm going to begin with my synthesis of the design dimensions for context-aware services. And the simplest kind of context-aware services is a location-based service. So we'll spend some time on location-based services. Then I'll talk about smarter services that use more than location as part of their context description. And finally, I'll talk about services which use sensor networks, that is, connected sets of sensors, sort of multiple contexts at the same time being aggregated or analyzed or something like that. And I'll just say a few words at the end about privacy, which I think is a limiting factor here that we need to be aware of. But let me begin with the first of my demos to motivate this idea of context-aware services. Glances, the best part of the movie.
Excuse me, sir. The doctor is here.
Check out, Miles. Good evening.
Have a nice day.
This is the teacher's new business.
I think that's very cool. Because he's such an obviously bad guy, right? Shoplifting in the supermarket and everything. Okay, turn that off. Okay. So there's a really amazing thing going on now, I think, in service system, which is this whole new context of context-aware services, pervasive computing, sensor network-based services, and you know, that little vignette there about the supermarket of the not-too-distant future, essentially in which you have RFID-tagged food and things, and you have sensors that check, do your checkout and all that. Again, it's a little edgy on purpose to give you the sense of this is a new, exciting future. But the future's been coming for a while. And there's a paper that I read. Well, I'll let you read this paper, and we'll decide when I read it. This is a paper called The Computer for the 21st Century, and it begins with this wonderful line that says, the most profound technologies are those that disappear. And in this paper, Mark Weiser writes about a technology vision where you see, because of this sensor vector that's out there, you recognize people by these sensors that they're carrying or these identifiers that they're carrying. Rooms can reach you by name. Telephones can forward you wherever you are in the world. You can walk up to a computer and it works for you. It has all your stuff on it, things like that. This paper was written in 1990. Okay, and it gives a sense that we've been getting here for a while. I think it's just finally reaching a kind of commercial viability that we haven't seen until fairly recently, but it's been a vision for a while. When I looked at all the papers that I read, and I assigned you a very small number of them, as Karen and HP know, we spent the whole spring reading papers in this area trying to find the right three. There are really a number of different design questions that I want to focus on today. The first one is, what exactly are we going to call the context? What information are we going to collect that we're going to call the context? How do we get it from the environment? We can get it from sensors of some kind. We get it from other services. And again, that's a very, very broad category. We can get information from sensors that we are in fixed location or known location. Or we can somehow treat finding the sensors and organizing them for this purpose as a task in its own right. We can drop a bunch of sensors into the environment and have them self-organized in order to let us then instrument a new environment. How smart is the information that the service gets when the service gets it? That is the sensor shoving some raw, unprocessed information, or is it doing a lot of local processing so that the information is already in some standard or processable or interoperable format? Another question is, what initiates that sending of the information to the service? Is the sensor pulling the environment, pulling information, or is the consumer or the object or person in the environment sort of initiating the sending of it? Is it requested or is it being sent? That's related to the schedule at which it's obtained. Is it obtained on a continuous basis? Are these things broadcasting context information? Or is there some schedule at which context information is picked up? Or is it basically we're picking up events? And again, what an event is significant because if we have picked up everything, we'll have a torrent of information, and that will become a problem. It's all right to sort of sift through the torrent for what's really interesting to us. And finally, the question of how the service processes what it gets. You can simply just collect it, do a simple transaction with it, where there could be more sophisticated things going on, where we have detected patterns in order to predict the behavior or trajectory or action of some object or person. We could try to integrate that information with some other service or operational application. So again, there's a big set of possibilities there as you go from sort of simple to more complex context-driven services. But let me begin by defining context. The most widely cited paper in this area is by Day and colleagues, and they define context in a way which you might not have thought about. They said basically it's any information which characterizes a situation that's related to the interactions between users, applications, and the environment, which means it's everything you could possibly imagine that could affect how you characterize some situation which you want to provide a service. Because the environment is people, places, things, objects in the world. And for each of those, you have information about its location, its identity, its status or activity, and some time in which something is taking place. So this is a 12-dimensional vector here we could be capturing about context. A very rich set of information about objects, places, people, for all these different things. And of course, that would be too much information. So the question is going to be, what do we sample from this set of possible context information in order to have a service that meets our specific requirements? And so people often say, well, it's location plus activity, or just location. Simplest possible context is just location. Okay, what does it mean to be context aware? This is a phrase I pulled out of one of the readings, and I've highlighted the key things to show the different parts of it. A device will exploit some technology to infer the current activity of the user and the characteristics in which that user is interacting in the environment so they can intelligently manage both the content and the means. So this, in fact, shows that context can be a crucial enabler, a component of a multi-channel or multi-device service system to help make the channels or the devices work in the appropriate way. So we pick up information from the context, which helps us figure out which device to use, which channel to use in the service system to optimally provide the service. Again, the boundaries aren't clear necessarily, but I want to show that you could think that context could be information which then shapes those other dimensions. But a key theme about context is this one, which you can think of context awareness as the substitution of information for interaction. So think about this. Context awareness means that your service doesn't have to ask certain questions. So, meaning in an interaction. We don't have to be explicit in an interaction if we can get this information in a more implicit way. So as we look at each of these questions, how would you answer this with some kind of sensor or device or computational service? So we say, where are you? How would we find this out? A lot of ways to find out where you are. GPS is one of the ways we can find. Well, there's actually many, many ways we could use it. If GPS is what people think of first, it's probably the most accurate. It's and maybe the most available if you have a smartphone. But there's many other ways to do that. Okay, you could say you're in the proximity of some other thing you know of, and this is the one that's talking to you. Okay, What are you doing or looking at or looking for? Again, you could be interacting with some object which can are expressing their context information to somebody else. You could have other, who are you with? You could be saying, who else has a cell phone that I can detect with my cell phone? I could create an ad hoc network of the Bluetooth connectivity between the devices. So I can infer people's presence by their devices that have been identified as their device. And there was actually a project here at the Art School several years ago where people gave had essentially smartphones, and they had their they were trying to tag pictures and know where to route pictures, that sort of upload Flickr to other people's collections and so on, based on who was around you when the picture was taken. It was called the MMM Project, and Mark Davis is the person whose name is most associated with that. What's it like there? That's a question about context, and that could be, well, it's daylight. What time of day is it in a very rough sense? It's nighttime, or it's hotter than hell here, or it's pouring rain, or, you know, any other kind of physical characteristic of the environment. You could think that could be important. But one thing you should see in the answer to these questions is this idea we talked about many times before this semester. We talked about process modeling, about the level of abstraction. Okay, what am I actually collecting? Am I collecting the temperature? It is. I get a number that says 61.5 degrees Fahrenheit, or am I getting a message saying hot? Okay, am I getting a message that says I'm next to Luba, or I'm getting a message saying I'm next to the cell phone with the following, you know, MAC address or whatever it would have? Okay, or, you know, where are you? I'm at this GPS coordinate, or I'm at home. Okay, very different kind of level of abstraction, which have a big implication for the kind of services you can provide. And the question is, where does that level of abstraction gap get crossed? Does it get crossed by the device, or does it get crossed someplace else? Well, the simplest service I can provide is one about location, where I just have one piece, namely, where am I? And we can do a lot of that. We do that. That's almost the default piece of context now for search providers, where we, if we do a search on a Google or Microsoft Bing or other search engines, they assume that if you ask for certain kinds of services or information, that it should be personalized to your where you are. So if I type in weather, I get the Berkeley weather, okay? Because it thinks it knows that I'm in Berkeley, okay? Other services that have local providers, like dentists or restaurants, if I type in restaurant for Berkeley at Microsoft Bing, I get first I get restaurant, but then it has in the left sidebar, it says, you know, local search. I click that and I get, boom, I get all the Berkeley ones. It fills in Berkeley, California as my local, as my location, and here I see restaurants, Chez Panisse, Kerala I've never been to, downtown I've been to, Lobato I've never been to. But these are in Berkeley, and they show up on this little map here. Now, the question you ask is, how many searches are local? What percentage of all searches you do are local? How many searches have a kind of implicit location and geographic modifier? Anybody have an idea about this? What percentage of searches do you make? Think about this. When you say, I'm searching for something, okay? Maybe if you're a student, you search for, like, papers a lot, okay? So maybe pretend you're like when you're not in your student mode. If you're an ordinary person who's, like, living in the world, using the web, and you type a query, turns out an awful lot of them are really location-based queries. Where's the restaurant? Where's the Home Depot? You know, where's this? Where's that? Okay? Where can I buy? When you say, you know, blue jeans, you're really asking, where can I get blue jeans? Most of the time. So, I don't know what the number, I'm sure that it's probably a majority of queries that are made by normal people outside of an academic context are probably local-based queries. That's just my guess. But how do we know what location is? When you think of ways to find location, we already have one, which is GPS. That means you have some device in your that can look at satellites and figure out where you are. Pretty accurately, in fact. How else would you know where you are? IP address. That's true. I mean, you can go to a lot of services and type an IP address and it'll tell you where you are. Actually, it'll tell you if it knows about the domain, where the domain is registered. Which is often where you are, but often not. If I type in my IP address from my San Lino house, I get Berkeley, California. Because that's where my name is on that IP address. Or that's where COVID's headquarters or something like that, because it's giving me the wrong city. But it's in the same state at least, the same country. Any other ways to know where location is besides IP address and GPS? Cell phone towers. You can use cell phone towers to triangulate within about 1,000 meters.
How about the convict anchor?
Oh, convict anchor. I mean, I don't have one of those on right now. How do those work?
I presume that they can identify.
So why don't you figure out how they work and tell us?
The other one I was thinking about, there's a company that puts a little radio transceiver in cars and they just relay in kind of serial fashion to identify, triangulate the location of cars and traffic.
That's the RFID fast tracker, right. Well, I think there's four, actually. IP addresses, which is the one that gets you locally, like city or region. Cell phone towers about 1,000 meters. You can have, there are Wi-Fi hotspot tracking services where you can, they say, what Wi-Fi signal are you next to? And they can figure out where you are within 100 meters. And finally, there's GPS. So, should we always use the most accurate one? Lewis shakes his head no. Why not? Exactly right. First, we don't need it. If I say, what's the weather? I don't have to need it. I'm asking, like, around me, like in Berkeley, not in this particular corner of the green lawn in front of South Hall. I assume the weather would be kind of monotonic over some period of space, right? Maybe a few miles or something. Okay? And again, it's not robust enough, as Luba said, if you can't really get it inside of a building, you have to line it out to satellites. But more importantly, and where is Stephanie and Karen about? This is something that they're working on. GPS doesn't tell you what the place means to you. It's a location. You're at 37 degrees north latitude, 122 degrees west longitude. Big deal. All right? What does that mean to you? So tell us about your master's project, Stephanie.
Well, actually, that last point, basically, creating a vocabulary or an API that allows users to save a certain location, whether that's something like home or work, or whether that's maybe what you're doing, you know, working on a project, or any kind of user-defined thing like that, so you can integrate that.
So you'll build a service which has tags, labels for locations in different contexts. Mm-hmm. And they have some wonderful use cases in their proposal. My favorite one is that you could have a service which is like your mother's service that says, you know, Kate, for the last week, all you've been is at home and at school. You know, take a day off and go like shopping or something. You're working too hard. Right? Is that a good service you could build?
Yeah, we have a few ideas like that about being able to, you know, pull up, for example, a file you worked on in different locations, for sharing with other services, like home automation,
It's pretty cool. So it's like you have to understand the ontology of meaning about location, not just the location in the lat long sense. So I'm looking forward to having next year in this class a nice 10 or 15 page paper about this problem and the solution so we can have it in the reading list. You agree to write that for us? Perfect. Okay. Another important location-based service that's a little more simple, little less simple than that one is location tracking. As objects are identified and timestamped in known locations, like when does your pallet cross the scanner in the warehouse, or when does your car cross the toll booth scanner for fast track. Another kind of service is where objects are identified in the location. This requires a little bit more infrastructure. LoJack is my favorite example of this. LoJack, you know what LoJack is? LoJack is named because it's the opposite of hijack. When your car gets stolen, it gets hijacked. Well, LoJack is a service you can have with a special kind of radio in your car, and when your port is stolen, They turn on the little LoJack signal, and all of a sudden, the people in the LoJack center go, ah, the car is there in the parking garage or in someone's backyard where they've stolen it. And then the police come and they put that thing that, that Jackson talked about on their legs. You know, they'll, and they put them in jail. Yeah. Yeah, you can say, is the car going close to where it's safe to shut it down? We don't want to like have it on the freeway in the middle of freedom, but if it's like on the side of the go, we're going to just turn the engine off, and the car stops. It's kind of hard to steal the car when you can't drive it anywhere. Okay? So it's a good service. One of my favorite ones is actually this one some of you have seen before, where you want to remember we had the E. coli scare a couple years ago when lettuce was spinach was contaminated? So Dole responded to that by starting to RFID tag vegetable boxes in the field. So here you see these farm workers with their RFID guns reading the scans in the field. Now this doesn't solve the problem because unless every manufacturer, every farm company does this, you still have supply chain which will have mixes of stuff in it. But it's a start. They're now putting clips of RFID or little radio things in cow's ears and in sheep's ears and in cattle's ears, and they kind of, when they wander around like, you know, the grazing in the grazing lands, they know where they are. They go, where the hell is Bessie? There she is, right? Okay? So this is actually an important political problem because in some places, like I think it's Wales, they wanted to make it required by law to tag your animals, your farm animals. And this was happening at a time when commodity prices were collapsing for the farmer. They're saying, we're losing money on our cows, we want to spend more money on tagging the damn things. No way. So they had like a big cow strike and everything else, and they didn't do it. But we're going to do that, more of that. I mean, tagging livestock and to keep track of things like that. Okay? But it raises a very interesting kind of contrast. And I'll just basically say, we want to tag two different kinds of heads of things. We could tag the heads of lettuce, we could tag the heads of people. Okay? So let's sort of compare tracking locations of ubiquitous service. Location track is now a ubiquitous service, but tracking stuff like a package or a pallet of lettuce isn't quite the same as tracking a person. Okay? And let me do the first couple, then we can have you guys generate the rest. It's a very long list that I came up with of ways that they're different and similar. So it's harder to identify a person who's a head of lettuce. And why is that? Because there's less need to uniquely identify a particular head of lettuce than there is a particular person. And lettuces may kind of travel in packs rather than as individuals. So that makes it a little easier to find the lettuce. The same head of lettuce only goes to the track once, probably from the field to the Safeway. Doesn't go around the block several times, I hope. You know? Whereas a person may go through the same path multiple times. In addition, the path that the lettuce can take is probably more restricted than the path that a person can take. The lettuce probably stays on the highway. And, you know, goes a certain set of stores or buildings, whereas people can go almost anywhere. But that doesn't mean that you shouldn't figure out where people go, because they may still have stereotype patterns. I mean, I know Kate probably goes to her apartment, and then she goes to the store, and then she comes to school. So even though she could go anywhere she wants, she probably goes to some places more than others. Isn't that right? And if we tracked her over a long period of time, we would know that. As do stalkers, right? So stalkers probably can follow people and know where they go, right? So I would just stalk, she probably goes to her apartment, she probably goes to school, she probably goes to the work. I could have you figured out in a week. I could stalk you, okay? Not that I want to or anything, but, you know, you could do it because people, even though they have the choice to go anywhere they want in the world, they still go to pretty typical places for them, okay? The way a piece of lettuce feels after its journey is probably objectively predictable. If it's had a bad trip and it got very hot or very dry or it got very wet or whatever it is, you can say, I can predict how this lettuce is going to be at the end of its journey based on these objective environmental factors. Whereas people, you know, may be a little bit more resilient or a little bit more different in their personalities, how they react to environmental conditions. Some people like it hot, right? Some like it hot. You've heard that phrase? Okay. So people may have different experiences of the same trajectory. I mean, even so, you know, even in the same trajectory, like going from here to New York, all the heads of lettuce probably go in the same way. Some of the people fly in first class and stay in the first class lounge. So there'll be differences even in the treatment on the same trajectory for people. That'll introduce noise in the tracking data, right? Okay. How else is tracking heads of lettuce and tracking heads of people different?
There are no privacy issues.
The lettuce doesn't care who's tracking it. Lettuce doesn't worry about privacy. Does it? I don't think it does. Okay? Whereas people will care a lot about who knows where they are, who's tracking them. Anything else? It's a related one about that. Think about the number of touch points that the lettuce undergoes. The lettuce, you know, doesn't care if it gets tracked over and over again, or if the person tracking or the machine tracking has a bad day, right? But, you know, I've had rather bad interactions with people who are tracking my location, like the TSA people, and I take it personally, and so lettuce doesn't take it personally, I don't think. It's related to the privacy issue. So I think it's an important contrast between tracking of stuff and tracking of people. That, you know, it's easy to track stuff by a lot. There's less complication. You don't have to get, you know, human subjects kind of people involved in, you know, worry about privacy laws. There's no FERPA for lettuce as far as I can tell. Okay, HIPAA and FERPA apply to people. They don't apply to lettuce. Have you ever heard of sense networks? I should have preloaded this. Sense Networks is a company that's doing building location tracking and pattern analysis based on people's cell phones. Is this working?
Oh. 12:05 p.m. Thursday, February 19th, 49th Street between 6th and 7th Avenues in New York City. Where did these three people come from before arriving here? Where are they going next? Companies like Sense Networks are compiling data like this from thousands of people and other sources. This animation contains the movements of 400 smartphone users in New York over the course of a month. They downloaded the company's software to their devices. In exchange, the software tracks their movements and eventually classifies them as members of one of 12 tribes.
Are you in the young and edgy tribe, or like to go out at night, or are you more of the homebody tribe, or the weekender tribe, which basically goes out of town on the weekends very often? And so we can put people into these types of tribes, and then, for example, we can say, well, where does my tribe hang out in San Francisco? Where do people like me, if I don't know San Francisco, where are they going to be hanging out tonight? Or any other city that I go to? So without having to know very much about the city, I can just look at a map and say, where's my tribe?
The maps are color-coded, which makes spotting this information easy. While users have the chance to learn about new places and where people like them hang out, companies have the opportunity to target them.
Now we can start saying, well, if you're in the young and edgy tribe and you're buying a product, for example, let's say you're interested in these brand new Nike running shoes, and you're the young and edgy tribe that also likes to go hiking on the weekends. Well, maybe we should advertise those shoes to other people like you and not to bother, let's say, somebody who's more of the homebody doesn't want the running shoes for hiking.
Sense Network software does not identify individual users who own their data and can delete it at any time.
Google's taking a different approach. With its new Latitude program, released in early February, you and your friends can track each other's location on your smartphones. Now, you might wonder why anybody would want to be tracked like that. But what we've seen over the last few years is that every time a new technology comes out that lets people share different types of information with friends, millions rush to it. Think of Flickr, Facebook, and Twitter. If location becomes the next big thing, Google and other companies are going to have enormous amounts of data about our movements and our behavior, which will help them pinpoint us with ever more precise advertising on speed dating.
That's a good thing, isn't it? All right. So there's this. Let me see if I can find. Go back to the. Okay. So go back to this. These are the pictures from the paper on Sense Networks in the Business Week article I just pointed you to. Here you see maps of downtown San Francisco, color-coded by different kinds of activities. You don't have to be able to see this at this distance. And you see that the patterns are different in the weekday night and the weekend day. It's saying, well, we can know where does this tribe go at certain times of the day or certain times of the week. Is it a good thing or a bad thing? Okay. All right. Another thing that's sort of a relatively simple service as things go is the idea that locations could be augmented with additional information. So this is an idea about layering virtual imagery and information over some real-world locations. All you really need is a GPS, a compass, and some connectivity, and you can basically say with your mobile phone app, be in some location and essentially have this information laid on top of the imagery that you are getting out of your device. So this is one I think is quite relevant to Luba's master's project, where he's looking at how people plan their multi-channel transit experiences. And there's actually a company that I think I referred you to that is the one on the left here, which you stand in some location and it tells you what the nearest transit options are for you and where you would go if you went to that particular station. So it's a way to kind of connect the maps and the routes, scheduling information for the transit systems into this virtual image that your location you're at. Is that a fair description? Did you look at it? Is that, tell you tell us more about your project?
So my project is a mobile transit navigator that helps you get around the Bay Area using different kinds of public transit applications. It's more of a design project with implementation. I've seen a lot of, I guess, augmented reality stuff for public transit, but I haven't found any of them useful yet, mostly because of limitations of the phone. Like, the compass on the phone so that it knows where you're pointing isn't accurate enough to make it really as a kind of, to make it as reliable as you'd want for public transit.
Okay. I was just intrigued by this. There's another article I found. Wikitude is a Wikipedia application that lets you essentially tag Wikipedia entries onto maps so that when you go to a certain place and you look at the map, you can pop the relevant Wikipedia description of that place. Things like that. There's a whole class of location-based services that are really location-based games. I've done very little of this except that one time I went geocaching with somebody. I bet you Stephanie's into this. No? Okay. But this is a location kind of game where the real-world location of the player sort of shapes the way the game develops. There's a notion of the user trajectory, which you can think of kind of as the service blueprint with touch points that are a mix of physical location and virtual location. So you're kind of moving between the physical and virtual worlds of these games. You can make them competitive or non-competitive, or you can make them even kind of performance art, where the way in which you play through this thing, you kind of go off and on. If you reach places at the appropriate time, then you do one thing, otherwise you do something else, and so on. There's a very interesting paper that I refer you to here if you like this kind of thing. I mean, there are a lot of examples cited in the paper, but in one of the reasons. But this is a more theoretical paper about the problem of designing these trajectory experiences in kind of the gaming environment. And geocaching, which many of you have done geocaching. This was so hot about a year ago. Is it passé already? Tell what the Girl Scouts do. Good, thank you.
And they use their GPS locators to either hike or walk around a city to find places where people have put stuff, random things. Like you sign a thing, or you take something, leave something, or you...
Good, I'm glad that some are still doing this. Yeah, Amy.
What's the purpose of the tablet chalk? Is it markers for... I don't know that we have to...
That's true. There used to be a lot of, yeah, people would make chalk marks on things. Well, as not a geocacher, I can't tell you, but I see that it's a class of location-based service in the kind of gaming in the, philosophy. All right, another big class of mobile-based services, location-based services, are these mobile guides. There was a huge survey of them in one of the papers, the Raper paper, so if you're interested in this sort of thing, you know where to go now for all the possible papers on it. These are GPS position client service solutions in which a user selects the content and display as you move through some environment. And this is very much like, I think, the thing that team, whatever your number is, the museum guide people are thinking about. Services where you have the ability to follow a tour and you learn about objects in the museum by either some interaction with the object, an RFID tag or something, you're able to then tag it back somehow. Can you tell us a little bit about that project?
Yeah, we are, in the RFID, we're sort of looking at barcodes on the,
okay,
the object. But yeah, we have not necessarily a path at this point. It's more of a collection of items in a museum. You would go up to the object, scan it with your phone, and then...
And you can then create your own little collection by tagging it in a certain way? Okay, again, because the papers, and again, I'm reading about this, say essentially that this works best when you have a relatively constrained space. Obviously, like, where can you drive your car? On roads. Where can you go to a museum? To the things in the museum. So because you know where people can go, you can kind of create little information tags or barcodes or whatever it is that will be the touch point for that service journey. A related area here is localized web retail. I mean, localizing, this has turned out to be a really, really important thing from the e-business standpoint. It turns out if you integrate information about the local availability of a product at a website, you can significantly, by an order of magnitude, increase the likelihood people will actually buy something. Put another way, people will not abandon the shopping cart if you have information about where they can actually get it locally. I have a bug in my slide. I shouldn't say conversion O rates. I should say conversion rates. Okay. So two sites that I really like here because they're generic sites. It's not just going to a site like Home Depot and finding that you can search the local Home Depot store. This is becoming a major, major idea in shopping sites of the scale of an Amazon almost, where a site like Krillion, you can site for almost any good you can imagine. I mean, 200 product categories, 1,000 brands, and say, where can I find a big screen TV here? And it pops it up and says, you can find them at these three Sears stores that happen to be in Richmond, Oakland, and Concord, which they obviously know where I am, even though I didn't tell them. And that looks pretty useful, as does... the find, again, this is where they are creating not just a shopping site with this ability to have local information, but they're also trying to integrate other kinds of social media things that would let people crowdsource and add information about the particular places that you can buy things. This kind of convergence of a number of these different kinds of location-based services. Again, there's a study I read that contrasted searches for online sites in general. Like if you're in your desktop computer at home and you're searching for something, you search for product types. But if you're on the road, if you're mobile, you tend to be looking more for specific stores. And this is a really wonderful demo of that.
So let me show you how our iPhone mall directory application works. This is where you can see you have an entire mall right in the palm of your hand. Every sale that's going on here in the mall.
You can find any store, you can search for products. If I want to click on sales, for example, they'll pop up all of the latest sales. Fred Meyer Jewelers, Wayne Bryant, Walking Company. Go back to home. Probably the most interesting thing that's on here is because the first time now you can actually search every shelf of every product in the mall, or every store in the mall. So for example, this looks like a lot of people are looking for engagement rings, so let's go ahead and try that one. Here's every store that currently carries engagement rings. Click on Fred Meyer Jewelers, looks like there's a sale going on there. And sure enough, you can see that a lot of the products are marked down. There's a certified 1-carat solitaire engagement ring.
Okay, you get the idea. We don't want to buy any engagement rings right now.
Click on it, it gives you a larger picture, and you can also get some details and find out where the Fred Meyer store is inside the mall. If I want to really zoom in, I just click on it and I can see a nice big picture. And if you're interested in buying this, there's a couple things you can do.
Okay. All right, and this taken to the logical extreme where you have location information, recommendation information, and so on, as you saw at the very beginning today, can really affect things at the individual store level. Here's a final retailing video about a German experiment called the Future Store. Weird sort of virtual reality. Why not just make it just people? I don't know how to have CGI stuff, but. Like you've never been in the store before. Turn left here. So you pull off the shelf, it goes in your cart, and then something else happens. There'll be information sent to the inventory, the update inventory and all that. A little hokey, but I do like the services. He's being told, get some more stock for that shelf. Okay, I'm gonna skip the rest of this. Because he's gonna check out very much like the first guy. She walks past the scanner and it basically checks her out. Because it knows what's in her cart and all that. Alright, so far we've shown you basically smarter services that are mostly location-based, maybe a little bit of information about the identity of the objects. That's a very small part of what we could be going here with context-aware services, because we have any object that has the ability to use electricity, so it could have a little bit of power, has the ability inherently to collect information about its environment and to do some processing on it. So the object could have history information, current information about its status, all kinds of information, and the technologies are basically there. It's not a question of technology, it's a question about figuring out new services for them. saw this picture in one of the table in one of the papers, cleverly photoshopped to squeeze it together a little bit so it fit on one slide. Why would you have to take up a whole page for this? I don't know why. But there's your list of possible properties that you could have sensors collect. And again, these are things which are now being talked about as sensors. Do you remember our discussion on Monday about what could be in your smartphone? I mean, you can imagine not very long now having things like, biological, detectors that can detect hazardous materials in the environment on your smartphone, or things like that. So this is, if these things are all going to be sensors, which are basically, I'm sure, being driven down in price, they'll end up on your smartphone. So everything you see here could end up being something which could be ultimately portable at the level of a mobile device, as opposed to being just in the environment. And this raises so many possibilities that you can have smarter services if you have smarter context information. I'm going to show you a number of them here that fall into some classes. The first one is remote monitoring, where you can have some environments or products or people being checked on by because of the sensor information that they have. We have a kind of remote monitoring of retail goods, which is called vendor managed inventory. We've already seen a little bit of that, I think. Maybe not so too much of that. We have the ability to monitor, but then to upgrade the capability of the device or the system we're monitoring by sending it information down, maybe improving the software on it or improving some other kind of capability. And finally, we have the ability to control that device in some way on the basis of what we learned through remote monitoring. How many of you have seen the airports where they have this sort of rich people's line where you can pay extra money to get a fast track through the airport by having biometric cards that you have? This now gives you the ability to, it knows where you are and who you are with this biometric data, identify you, blow through the airport fast. Okay? We can monitor people, monitor the elevators people use. Otis Elevator now has a service called Remote Elevator Monitoring, not the one in this building. It's always going down, but they monitor 10,000 elevators in the United States. Major part of the revenue, because instead of having to send the elevator guy to fix it preemptively, they can know when it's about to need a tune-up. They go fix it when it needs it. And as a result, they have no wasted service calls. They always know what the problem is when they show up. Elevators work more efficiently. So essentially, they're now selling the service of, we keep your elevators running. And instead of having to pay for service calls, you pay for elevator uptime. They guarantee you 99.99% uptime, and that's what you pay for in the service. Some of you know that I have a surveillance system on my house in St. Helena, so I can see how things go when I'm not there. My system will, I took a picture of my house from a camera, it will send me mail if it detects motion. So for a while I thought it was a great feature because I'd get these emails that said motion detected. See, that says event filter and so on. This is the camera, different cameras and so on. Okay. The problem is that I was getting lots of email because of birds and because of the people who come to look at the pool. I was getting like 25 a day, and I said, you know what? Maybe the alarm's not quite tuned right, but so I don't use this thing. But it can send me mail if it detects motion. Likewise, I have solar panels on my house in St. Helena. It sends me mail when they go down. So this is my mail I got this week saying that, gee, my power is not, my inverter is not putting on any power. And it's sunny, so what's up with that? Okay, yes?
It happened to me when I was in the bakery. I worked there, and we have
right.
And then all of a sudden, a guy from Sweden called me.
And says, the door's open.
Yeah, and I was like, what?
That's great, isn't it?
So the fridge sent
the refrigerator sent a message saying, my door's left open. Somebody left the door open, damn it, come close it. Why couldn't it just close it itself? It'll actuate to pull the door shut.
I don't know. So I asked him where he's at. He's like, I don't see
him. So, I actually like this. Because I always go, what's wrong with my network? And I go figure out if I can reboot it and everything else. And But the solar panels send me trouble reports. What I just discovered this week is the new Coca-Cola machine. Have you seen these machines? Well, you got to look at them. Are you playing? There's a touch display that has 100 different choices of beverages on this machine. 100 different choices. You're saying, so what? Well, how many? Yes.
That's great from an environmental perspective, just because then you incorporate the water on site, not be shipping water on site.
Right, so does anyone know how this works, Stephanie? It has, instead of having to have, you know, limited to 8 different beverages, 100 different beverages you can make on demand from highly concentrated, you know, syrups and stuff that are in this machine, all with RFID tags on them so they can send information about their state. When they need to be replaced, the Coca-Cola machine sends messages to the local Coca-Cola people. Say, come change the following tab, the following dispenser, you know, things. And they, of course, are tagged in ways that they only, if the repair person or the service person puts them in wrong, they won't work. So it tells them whether they're in right or not. So all this stuff is automated. They have dozens of RFID tags and sensors in this box. It's a complete trade secret. They won't tell anybody. But it is a huge advance, because it means that instead of having to have, you know, a limited offering of, say, 10 things in one machine, which is not that many when you have a product line of 100 possibilities, they can have one machine which has their entire product line in it. Yeah. Maybe that's the policy of Burger King, where this is being trialed, that you can have a big refill. So that may be, in fact, the way the service is being deployed in Burger King for the trial, as opposed to how the thing actually works. I'm sure they can keep it from spilling. Sunny.
I also wonder, a lot of people like to mix different kinds of juice together, if it allows that kind of juice.
I don't know. I mean, I didn't spend a lot. I read this for, like, you know, 20 minutes, and I thought it was cool, so I put it in, but I didn't read the history of the device. Yes, Stephanie.
I think one of the other interesting things that's in the same piece that I read is actually talking about the new services that they rolled out international. So they were finding that Coke was getting really, like, the brands getting really diverse, but across other, you know, countries, and they were, like, matching up ads and different kinds of brands. They made this online, like, ad campaign builder. So if you're like the, you know, Egyptian, you know, Coke, you know, there's a festival and you're a sponsor, you can go and you can pick, you know, I want a banner that displays, you know, happiness that is this big, and it, like, you can use, like, pre-approved stock photos. I found that fascinating as a sort of, like, franchise, or whatever you call it. You know?
So they mean this little display can be used for other purposes, like to put up ads and messages?
Not just this, but the whole Coke brand.
Oh, okay.
You can get posters made, or you can get, you know, banners, or any kind of ads. So it's a service for the local manager,
right,
to use to create their ad campaign.
Well, one thing that's really important here is the third one of these bullets. It says, consumption data helps Coke and fast food outlets decide what to serve and promote and when and where to launch new products. And so you have microscopic detail about which dispenser sells which ones. And so you can clearly tune, you know, which cartridge you put in each device and all and that kind of thing, which is, you know, and you can obviously optimize your service intervals of that way and so on to really make this a very efficient way to sell Coke. I think we've already talked about OnStar. OnStar is this thing that you have in the GM cars or some of them. You can either get it on demand or by event driven, but it will send you email saying, here's the current snapshot of how your car's doing. Because we have all the sensors on your car, we recommend that you take your car in for service because the following things needs a little work or something like that. So it's not just the thing for tracking your car when it gets stolen. It actually sends you performance data on demand, or if, as you need it, tells you, you know, how your car is working. And again, this is really good not just for the consumer, but it gives the manufacturer enormous data about the reliability of the components in the car, which you couldn't get before. Because if you had a car before, you could be running it into the ground before you take it to the dealer or to get it fixed. Or you could just never get it fixed. It runs around clunking along with a lot of pollution coming out the back end of it. This way they know exactly how the cars are running, which parts are having trouble. It ultimately will make them make much better cars if they can use the data that they've got. Now, this, of course, is, so far we've been monitoring a lot of things. Let's try monitoring people. Remote patient monitoring is really big. In fact, there's a team here doing a lot of work in that area, the Crohn's disease team. So I want them to check me out on this one here. When I was about 20 years ago, there was a classic commercial. I've got to show you this commercial. Oh, no, that's not what I wanted. I wanted this.
When I became deathly ill, I was able to summon an ambulance to my next door neighbor.
What's going on?
Family and my doctor were on the phone up a telephone.
What's going on here?
Oh. My 24-hour emergency medical response service. What?
Oh, there it is. Sorry. Kill that, kill that, kill that. Sorry.
When I became deathly ill, I was able to summon an ambulance, my next door neighbor, my family, and my doctor.
Love that hair.
I used this remote control to contact LifeCall, my 24-hour emergency medical response service. What? You just press this button and speak into the air and...
I'm having chest pains!
I'm calling paramedics and your family, Mr. Miller.
I'm fallen, and I can't get up!
We're sending help immediately, Mrs. Fletcher.
See? Protect yourself with LifeCall, and you're never alone. To get complete free information by mail about this affordable medical emergency response system, call toll-free now.
Life calls and save your life. So call to get free details by mail right away. Old style commercial. Isn't that great? That's like 1970-something. It's now been superseded by a little bit better technology. But this idea about having aging in place with what's being called assistive technology is viewed as a way to vastly improve the quality of life. You don't have to have go to a nursing home or something like that. You can have be at home. And we have three classes of service. We have assurance of services. Mrs. Miller, you're all right. We have this device. We can find you if you have a problem. Support services. That is, we can do things to help you compensate for one of your impairments. And we have assessment services, which is actually collecting the data that's just figuring out how you are. Now, there are actually low-tech ways to do a lot of this. Some people discovered a long time ago that if they simply kept track, you know, when they had cable TV first put in, what shows you were watching, and you were an old person at home, that was really good because old people get pretty stereotyped when they're watching TV patterns. They always watch the same shows, the same days, and so on. So if on Wednesday morning, Oprah didn't get turned on, then Mrs. Miller must be having a problem, and they sent someone out there to figure out what's going on with it, because she always watches Oprah at 10 o'clock in the morning on Wednesday. So you can use the cable TV box as a pretty reliable way to detect anomalies in your behavior patterns. Okay? Another clever thing to do is, you can imagine if you have the old person is told, well, come online every morning and do the New York Times crossword puzzle online or something like that, or some other puzzle or some other kind of thing which is a way to assess your cognitive abilities. If you come on and you can't answer any of the questions, maybe you're having a stroke or something. We should go figure out, well, you can't answer any of the questions on this game or crossword puzzle. So we don't have to be very clever about this. We don't have to be very technologically capable, but we can do a lot of inferences based on the idea of having a model of what the patient's normal behavior is. But we're getting very sophisticated now. Philips has a whole product line and service line around remote patient monitoring. You can't see this picture because there's a lot of detail here, but basically a lot of stuff going on here with the all the devices in your home, like smart scales, that not only measure how much you weigh, but they measure how stable you are on the scale. Are you standing up vertical straight, or are you wobbling? If you're wobbling, that's a problem. That's a piece of information we want to send to the doctor. Okay? And so all these different things here can get sent to the doctor and the care manager, who is sitting there saying, this is an anomalous pattern. Maybe we should tell the doctor about this, and we should do something about it. Okay? Is there anything you guys want to add to this kind of class of stuff?
Well, the only difference in our system is that the patient's cell phone kind of mediates the exchange between the network and all of their local devices.
But yeah, this is a huge thing. And as people get older, people like me get older and creakier, we'll be strapped to machines like crazy, sending messages to Adam Bosworth and this team. You guys know everything about me. Bob just fell down. I'm falling and I can't get up. Jackson.
It's a bit vulgar, but I think in Japan they have a medical toilet that contacts your doctor based on what it finds.
That's brilliant! That's fantastic! Bees have to go get a lab work done. That's fantastic. Well, what else would you be able to monitor? I mean, you know, what you eat, right? You could have the refrigerator and know what comes out of the refrigerator. You could scan it as it comes out of the refrigerator. I'm eating this container of this or this amount of this. You can know what your diet is. You can know all kinds of stuff.
Oh, I know about another aging one. I'm not sure if it was actually ever made or if it was just studied. But I think it was in Japan, and it was a tea kettle. So that if you were an older person, you made tea, then it would send a message to the family, like, Mom's fine. She made tea this morning.
That's good. Mom made her tea. That's really good to know. Okay. Some of you remember My Life Bits from 202. There's now a commercial version of that.
Camera that automatically takes photos throughout the day could transform the lives of people with memory loss. The SenseCam was developed in Cambridge, and already it's proved successful in trials with people with Alzheimer's.
Looking through images of a day out in Cambridge, for someone with memory loss, this might be their only way to recall what they've been doing and who they've seen. It's all been captured on a tiny camera called SenseCam.
It's important not to try and remember everything. We naturally forget the minutiae of everyday life, and they remember the more specific and more meaningful parts of their life. And that's really what we're trying to do by helping people who do have a memory impairment. We tell them to wear only specific events and things they think are going to be important to their life.
An initial trial of 20 patients with Alzheimer's and other forms of memory loss has given excellent results. Rekindling memories of special events others may take for granted.
Pretty cool. All right. And again, there's this is migrating very fast to the smartphone because you have the ability to do things like augmented reality, where you can have your camera and it can label things like watch out for the potholes on the street as you're walking down the street. You might want to fall down. There's an alternative approach where you can have a blind person with a smartphone and have the smartphone know where it is and tell someone in the back room there saying they're in a dangerous spot where it's hard to walk around. Call them and give them some directions, things like that. So again, these services which combine them with the things we've seen so far. But what we've seen so far up to now have been the services which are essentially, while they're more context is used than just location, they're still relatively simple in that they're not using sophisticated models about what to expect. So the smartest services are those which are based on models where there's a service application which is based on having analyzed the pattern of behavior of the people and things in the environment, and then we can recognize deviations from those activity patterns. That's really relatively easy to do if you have one person. It gets more interesting and more difficult if you have multiple actors in the same environment. That might mean more than one person in the house, because they'll do things differently because they're together than they would if they were by themselves. Or as some of us saw yesterday, multiple people driving their cars around Seattle. And in the talk by Eric Horvitz, where you have to deal with the fact that people interact with each other and their behavior is shaped by what other people are doing. So this idea that we would model for prediction, you get a kind of baseline for that will let you automate or analyze or make things more secure or more efficient or whatever it is. And you do this in a way which says, well, are you on the right trajectory that I expect you to be on at the right moment and the right time? And people use things like game theory to say, well, you optimizing your behavior, and we can tell whether you're doing something which is not what we expect, what's causing you to not follow the rules of your behavior, and so on. And that's where we get to sensor networks, where we have this ability to use multiple people or multiple sensors in kind of at the same time to collect an enormous amount of data. Some of these things, they're actually called motes in some contexts, where they're little devices about this size, and they're a little battery-powered, and they're sensors, and they even can throw them out of airplanes into like fires or disaster scenes, and they will self-organize to create an ad hoc network that will then collect data about what's going on there. A good example of that is this one here. From a company called Crossbow, which appears to be the market leader here in the valley. Lots of applications of this stuff. Is this doing something? Yes, it is. That's why its problem is this air bear. So this is the idea that there's a sensor grid being formed that will then pass off as data to some more powerful data cruncher. Do I have to close these? Does that help? Maybe I should let this load and come back to it. Oh, there it is. There it is.
Hospital's wireless mesh networks are easily installed where there is little or no power and IT infrastructure. Each node communicates wirelessly with other nodes, creating a vast self-forming and self-healing network, even in the most adverse conditions. With Crossbow's sensor platforms, you can make the most of every opportunity because you have the data and information to understand the present. Crossbow intelligent sensory system let you monitor and capture data that was previously hidden or hard to get. That data can be turned into real-time information you can use to run your business. Fortune 50 companies use Crossbow's platforms to...
I'm going to stop this. Did you get the idea? Again, these things could be dropped out of airplanes or deployed widely in an environment like a vineyard. To collect data about the environment. The problem, of course, is that this means it's an enormous amount of data being generated, and if you're not careful, you will drown in data. So there's a lot of work to figure out what the significant events are. And that means a lot of that pattern analysis, number crunching, to figure out you know, what the baseline is and when you can detect deviations from it. One we saw yesterday in this talk by Eric Horvitz was involved vehicle-to-vehicle applications, which, if think about it, if cars have sensors that can communicate with each other and the baseline infrastructure of the sensors and the road grid, you have a network on wheels. Cars could relay information about accidents or congestion to other cars through this network. But would you want your car to control your behavior? Maybe some of those old folks would, who'd fallen down in the back seat and let the car drive itself, but somehow I don't want the car driving itself. I want to be able to still have information that I then make decisions with. But again, the goal is to have a smart grid, that transportation system which will let us use sensors in the roadway as well as sensors in the cars and mobile devices and people driving around to do this kind of community sensing, it's being called, to collect information from a large number of devices to provide like real-time data across some wide spatial area. One of my favorite examples of this sort of stuff is precision agriculture, where you have sensors in your fields as a farmer, and you're able then to use sophisticated applications that use information about soil conditions and topography and daylight and water and everything else to figure out how to fertilize your fields, how to drive your tractors. It's amazing to watch these guys talk about it.
Farmer Lowell is getting a lot more work done on the farm these days. Lowell is one of a growing number of farmers using GPS precision guidance technology to work the fields.
Does this simplify everything? Like, is this a takeover?
I get in the truck, I listen to the country western music, and the truck does everything else.
GPS receiver to literally steer tractors by sending messages to the tractor steering system. The iTrack technology tells the tractor where it needs to travel in the field. Then, with great accuracy, it automatically steers the tractor to the right place.
It's allowing farmers, first of all, to be able to run later in the day. Be able to
drive at night?
Be able to run in conditions that they wouldn't have been able to run in the past, and overall just improve their operation efficiency.
It's also helping farmers save money while helping the environment. The precision guidance system reduces operator fatigue as well as passes in the field. This saves on fuel and fertilizer because the GPS helps these tractors go in a straight line down the row and turn automatically, so there's no overlap and no waste.
It allows us to make a little more money if they're on the internet. You know, we save a little bit on our seed corn, and the chemical cost has reduced that all. I mean, it's lowered all those costs by not wasting them.
That has greatly reduced.
It's great.
Fuel we use.
It's great. I mean, GPS-driven tractor. The guy sits there and listens to his country best music the whole time, and the truck does everything for him. All right. Okay. One thing that sort of lurks in the background of a lot of this stuff is the issue of privacy. How willing are people to give up information about their current or previous context? Now, I worry about that a lot, but I worry a lot less about it from my commercial providers than I do about governments, because imagine what governments would do if they knew, like, that you were talking to people who were bad people and they knew who you were and things like that. And so it's, I want to apply this question to the problem of the smart home. I mean, think about the idea that, I mean, right now you have an energy company which reads your bill, reads your consumption once a month, let's say. Once a month they figure out how much you've used in electricity. What can they infer from that? Well, you have a big family, but you use a lot of time, but they know very coarse level stuff. What could they infer if they had continuous monitoring of electricity use? What would they know about you and your lifestyle? They know when you're home. They know if you have a meth lab in the basement, or if you're growing dope in the basement with big lights in there, right? What else would they know? They would know what appliances you own. Because every appliance has a particular energy signature, and you just do the Fourier analysis and deconstruct the waveform into the components. They know that they want the microwave, they want the big screen TV. You want a big screen TV? What model is it? Let's send you, sell you an upgrade or sell you some new stuff for it. Or they know who you are, what your preferences and products are. They know what your lifestyle is. Do you actually live what you claim to live? Remember a couple years ago, the guy named Ed Ju was supervised in San Francisco? He lied about his residency. He actually lived in Daly City. He said he lived in San Francisco. He's in prison now for lying about his residency and avoiding taxes and taking bribes and a bunch of other stuff. But he lied about where he lived and they figured that out. Okay? He could do it. I look at your bills. He's not home. The lights are always off. You could create to rob people. We know when they're not home. So there's clearly some good and bad aspects of good connectivity here, right? So your insurance rates will be affected. You get into legal trouble. Big Brother will say, you know what? I think you're using too much electricity. I'm going to stop giving electricity between 4 and 6 p.m. on Wednesdays because you're wasting it then anyway. So I'm going to cut you back to half what you've been using. That could happen here, right? So there's a downside here. Well, I have two more ideas before we stop. I mean, one is that most of what we've talked about so far is context awareness in a single environment at a time. It could be the home, could be the office, could be your hotel, could be the highway, whatever. But just as we talked last time about UIs that kind of flow across devices, why shouldn't context awareness flow across context? And sort of, I think Seva hinted at this about knowing whether you're home or at work and the transitions between those contexts. You could actually provide support for the transition and the overall activity, the goal of both contexts together if you knew more about what you were doing there. Results of interesting issues about technology,
legal issues to get there, but I think that's where we're going to go for sure. To support multiple contexts as an aggregation of a user model of how you live your lives, if you want to let that happen. Let me summarize today's lecture, that we have location is the easiest context attribute and easy to get most of the time, but it's one of a very open-ended set of context variables. And I think the variety that we could have of that depends on how many senses we have, and that's probably open-ended too over time. It's easier to get context about things than about people, but it's still very useful to monitor people and exploit what you know about their context. And as we saw at the end, sensor networks of things and people are an extremely active area of research and innovation. So with that, we're done with seven contexts. I mean, this basically has been a tour of the seven building blocks of service systems. And I think the idea I had was that it has, by limiting the descriptive vocabulary of complex systems, you can do a better job of building things in an incremental way, understanding how these things fit together. Because they are, as you've seen, they are, as you saw in the continuum from person to person to self-service, as you saw the relationship between multi-channel and self-service and so on, these things fit together in various ways. They follow design patterns. And that lets us generate ideas for service systems in a way which is much more productive than just thinking of them as one-offs all the time. It also lets us see things how we can substitute from one context to another. We can say, what does it mean to substitute a person for a machine or to substitute an abstract interface so we can have transparent substitutability of the service provider, things like that. So I hope that you're now able to invent solutions in your problem areas in a way which was unimaginable 10 weeks ago, because you have a much richer repertoire of these building blocks, especially the last three of multiple devices, multiple channels, and multiple contexts. I think it's really powerful stuff. So that I want to stop.